The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So before Mark left, he was doing a series of talks on the paramis, or the 10 perfections of the heart, and so I'm going to continue on that topic this evening. The first of the paramis is generosity, and I'm going to finish up talking about the practice of generosity tonight, and then start talking a little bit about the second parami, which is sila, or morality. And the paramis are just qualities that we attempt to explore and to investigate and to practice that lead us to understand how not to cling, how not to act from a self-centered point of view. So we've talked about Mark talked about the natural generosity of the heart, just the idea that things are, that there's just the natural tendency of the heart to be generous. And in nature, we see this sort of generosity of what we are receiving all the time. And as part of nature, we also have this impulse to give. So there's just this flow of giving and receiving that can occur. It's part of nature. Mark also talked about understanding our intention to be generous, and the reason that stinginess tends to stand out so strongly is that there is this this deep aspiration for us to be generous. We know that when we're generous, that we know how the heart feels, and we know how the heart feels when we move towards stinginess. So there's just this natural tendency to want to develop that generosity, that natural generosity. I was reading an article in the New York Times this week, and I came across a quote that I like quite a bit, and it said, don't become cynical because so much evil is public and so much good is private, so much generosity is private. So I think it's important to us, especially if we you know, we have so much input from the news these days, and so much of it tends to point out the public evil. And so for us to have this intention to be aware of how much private good there is. So we, with this practice of generosity, we just have this intention of becoming more in touch with what is freely given and what is freely received. Talked also a little bit last week, I think it was, or the week before, about this being open to receiving. A lot in our culture, there's sort of this thing like we're very self-sufficient, and so if there's somebody acts generously towards us, sometimes there's sort of a discomfort that arises. And with this practice, we can have the intention of when someone is giving to us, that we can really open ourselves to that, be really present in that moment to receive the gift that is being offered. And in that way, we honor the gift and we honor the giver. So I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about gratitude and the practice that that I've really found to be beneficial. I think that there are various types of personalities, and some people are just more naturally aware of gratitude, of being grateful for what is what they're given, and other people tend to have a little bit less awareness and openness to that, and I've kind of intended to be one of those on that end of the spectrum. So I found it really helpful to have a formal practice of gratitude, and especially when sometimes, when things are difficult and you can kind of get spinning into that that state of feeling sorry for ourselves or wanting things to be different, that we can, of course, try and turn towards that and open to that. That's part of our mindfulness practice. But if we find that we're just sort of spinning in that that place of feeling like sorry for ourselves or feeling like we, why me, or like we'd like things to be different, then we can actually do the practice of bringing things to mind that we're grateful for, and that can kind of help to grease that avenue of the mind, that inclination of the mind, so that it's when we do those kind of practices, then it just naturally will occur that the mind will be more likely to turn towards that kind of skillful mind state. So on Friday, I had a circumstance arise that illustrates this, and I could really see that. Another tendency has been like, it's so easy to, as I mentioned, not to be so open to receiving, to kind of feel that. That it's a burden, maybe if somebody's going to give us a gift, maybe it's a burden on them, and we so feel like we are not deserving or whatever. So on Friday, I was at work, and my boss brought me a contract that was needed to be delivered on Monday morning, and so I put it in the UPS overnight envelope and put the label on it. And then a little while later, he came out and he said, "Oh, I forgot. We should actually send two copies so they'll sign one and they'll return one." I said, "Oh, that's right. We should definitely do that." So and he gave me a second copy to send because he had to sign it. And so I opened up the envelope, and then I realized that I started looking. There was no glue in the office, and so I couldn't close the envelope. So, and I think my mind was not functioning too well Friday afternoon. It was kind of like, okay. So, it really wasn't functioning very well. So I got another envelope, and put the new contract in it, and I ripped the old envelope in half to recycle it, and forgetting that I had not taken the other copy of the contract. And my boss had already left for the day. So then, oh man. So I had already made a PDF file of it, so I had to make that into a Word document, and then I used that as the other one to put in the envelope, and so this is close to the end of the day, fortunately, so I start driving, I drive home, and that's like kind of in a crappy mood. I had sort of thought that I had sort of, gone with that, and now this is the way things are, but I don't know, I think I was kind of, so I was kind of like, on the way home. So then I realized that I could let go of the bad mood, and I got home and went to get out of my car, and I saw that I had forgotten to drop it off in the UPS box. So I walked into the house, and my sister was in the kitchen, and she said, "Oh, how was your day?" So I told her my sad story, and I was coming to Common Ground to do the Metta group on Friday night, and I was kind of a little bit crunched for time at that point, although I could have gone over to drop it off where I needed to go. But my sister said, "Oh, I can drop it off for you. I'll be happy to drive over and deliver it to deliver it for you. You can listen to my music or whatever." And it was just, I felt just so supported. I was just so touched by that, that act of generosity. I felt just really grateful for her generosity. And so I think in the past I might have said, "Oh no, I can't accept you. It's Friday night for you too." And but it was really easy. I was just really able to accept it. And she was fine. She hadn't had such a bad afternoon, so she had some energy to take care of it. So. So another thing that we can do to develop this attitude of gratitude is we can just have an intention to be more aware of pleasant things in our lives. Just sometimes we can kind of have this tendency to sort of the things that we need to take care of and the things that are difficult kind of tend to grab our attention more. And so we can just have this intention to turn our minds more towards noticing all of the pleasant things that that arise in our lives and to feel the gratitude that's connected with having that awareness of what's pleasant. And it can be really simple things of just, when we notice beautiful things in nature, or sometimes we, maybe a child will see a child and it will just kind of give us that feeling of connection and of joy, and just to notice those things when they arise. And then, as I mentioned, we can also have maybe have a more formal practice of gratitude where we actually set aside a time each week or each day where we can just sit down for a few minutes and just reflect on maybe even write down the things that have occurred in that day or in the past week that we feel gratitude for. And so that can help again to incline the mind towards these skillful mind states. Santi Carl spoke here a couple of weeks ago. He was his talk was on busyness, and one of the things that he mentioned during that talk was he said that there are at least a couple of meanings to the word mindfulness or sati in Pali. that there is the idea of being aware moment by moment of our experience and being open to whatever that is. That's one definition of mindfulness. But there's also the definition of mindfulness that it is remembering. And so it can be really helpful to have a time where we can sit down and reflect, and either as in this practice of gratitude where we can recall things that we're grateful for, or we can use it in many instances, like for instance, maybe if we're looking at greed and aversion, we can kind of look back over the day at times when we've wanted things or haven't wanted things, and just kind of reflect on what our reaction to that was, and look at if that reaction was wholesome or unwholesome. And so in this way, when in our lives, things tend to happen pretty quickly. And so sometimes it's hard in the moment to bring our this kind of non-judgmental awareness into that moment. But by taking time to reflect, we can, it kind of primes the mind for the future, so that when things arise, that we're more likely, the mind is more likely to turn towards the being open and then non-judging to whatever is happening, if we've kind of primed the pump through this process of reflection. So now I'd like to move on to the second parami, which is sila, translated as virtue or morality. And in his teachings, the Buddha presented three areas of training that lead to liberation from suffering. And those three areas of training are sila, virtue or morality, samadhi, concentration, practice of developing concentration, concentrating the mind, and panya, which is wisdom or insight. And as a result of the practice of developing the morality and concentration, then insight tends to naturally arise out of those trainings. This is a quote from my first teacher, Shenzhen Yang. It's called The Path. And he says, if anybody asks you what the path is about, it's about generosity, it's about morality, it's about concentration, it's about gaining insight through focused self-observation. It's about cultivation of subjective states of compassion and love based on insight. And it's about translating that compassion and love into actions in the real world. So it's good for us to sort of have this sort of framework that we can put the practice into. And so that we know that the practice of generosity and the practice of morality, the concentration that we develop through meditation, and the insight and wisdom that arises out of that, that then we can naturally take that and joining it with the metta practice, cultivating compassion, the joining together of the wisdom and the compassion, make our actions in the world much more beneficial than if we don't take the time to reflect on those possibilities. So sila is really central to this tradition that we're practicing. And there are five training precepts, or Thich Nhat Hanh calls them mindfulness trainings. And the five are to refrain from harming, so it said refrain from killing, but more completely it's refraining from harming, not harming, having the intention not to harm other beings. The second precept is not taking what is not given. Sometimes this is said not stealing, but more completely is to think of it as not taking what is not given. The third is not lying, not using harsh or divisive speech. The fourth is refraining from sexual misconduct. And the fifth is not ingesting intoxicants or things that cloud the mind. So we can, it's good for us to remember that these aren't commandments, that they're not shoulds, like you shall not steal, you shall not kill. They're not commandments, because those aren't things that are imposed on us from the outside. And these precepts that we undertake to train in are things that that we choose to do because we see a benefit to them. If we don't see a benefit to them, then it's not skillful for us to choose to do them. But we do know that the human character is not fixed. It's definitely changeable, moldable. We can make choices that affect the conditions that will arise, and so we can take responsibility for our reactions to things. And then we can see how we can become aware and notice what the effect is when we make those choices. And we can notice what the effect is when we don't make those choices. And then we can the mind becomes more more aware of what the possibilities are, and tends to incline more to when it's making skillful choices. So a couple of years ago, I was at a 10-day retreat with Steve Armstrong and Kamala Masters at the Christine Center. And the center is really lovely. It's way out in the rural area, and the grounds are very beautiful. And it's quite remote. The first time that I went there, I was driving down the road and towards the center, and a deer ran across in front of me. Quite beautiful. And I drove along a little further, and a large turtle line was crossing the road. And a little bit further, I drove along, and a black bear ran across the road. Whoa! Really going into the into the countryside here. So the bears don't come to the center, but the deer do. And it's really quite lovely. They'll come right up by the meditation hall, and they graze and see them out the window, especially in the evening. And sometimes they have their fawns with them. It's really quite sweet. So I woke up on the last morning of the retreat, and I remembered this dream that I had had. And in the dream, I was walking down the path, and I came across a leg of a deer. And so I thought, I felt some fear and thought, well, you know, perhaps I better go back to the, you know, turn back. But I thought, well, it's okay, I'll walk on a little further. So I walked on a little further. Line of a path, and I thought, ooh, you know, something here that, you know, could be kind of dangerous. But I thought, well, maybe I need to find out what it is, because if it's dangerous to me, it could be dangerous to other people as well. And so I walked on, and sure enough, I came a little bit further down the road, and there was a lion. And then it was like, oh, that is dangerous. Of course, in a dream, you don't find it too surprising to find a lion in rural Wisconsin. But So I boldly took the lion by its fur. And I knew that there was a cage that was back up the path. And so I kind of guided the lion up the path. And as I got a bit closer, it started nipping at my hand. And then I thought, well, you know, this is pretty unpleasant. But after all, I've been on a 10-day retreat, so I don't think I thought that in the dream. But so I did. I got the lion into the cage, and felt like things. But there was some safety that had been restored to the area. So, and I just like that metaphor as the that, you know, the when the mind faces something that's dangerous and is willing to be with it, then the mind can come to a place of safety by facing that, whatever that, if it's fear or anger or whatever emotions arise, that the mind is, as the Buddha has clearly said, is trainable. The Buddha taught that there are three types of people in the world, and he called them uninstructed worldlings, the trainee, and the arahant, or the fully enlightened being. And he said that the uninstructed worldling is not able, has not either not heard this possibility of the mind being trained, or has heard it and hasn't been able to absorb that teaching. And so they are just at the mercy of the conditions of the world, and at the mercy of suffering from whatever arises in their life, and not having a lot of control over working with those conditions, just not understanding the possibility of it. And the arhat, or the fully enlightened being, does not need these training precepts any longer, because these impulses no longer arise in them. They have purified their consciousness to the extent where the harmful mind states no longer arise in them. But the trainee has heard about these trainings in sila, samadhi, and panya, virtue, concentration, and insight, and they have chosen to take some responsibility for working with these trainings. And that's what we were doing this evening. We sat in meditation, when we, you know, just sitting in meditation for this period of short period of time, we are really practicing the precepts, because we sit quietly, pretty much not harming anything. Maybe ourselves a little bit, depending on what our mind is doing. But we have an intention to not be harming ourselves either. And there might be some, we're not taking anything. We're not doing any sexual misconduct, or we're not using harsh speech. We're refraining from taking intoxicants. So just sitting quietly and practicing the development of concentration, where we are practicing the training precepts. So we can feel good about that, you know, the benefit of our choosing to do that. These are also precepts that are taken at retreats, so that the retreatants agree to, for the period of the retreat, to abide by to the very best of their ability to these precepts. And so that really makes the container of the retreat a very safe place for people to practice. And it's often commented, I've heard many comments after retreats of how people felt this, you know, just the safety of this, even though, you know, they were sitting with, you know, the 40 other people, 50 other people who we really don't know. There's still this this real feeling of safety, this communal intention to not harm, and it's a very powerful and potent feeling. To take a minute to read from just a little excerpt from a book that was written by Ajahn Amaro. He's a Western monk, a Westerner who became a monk, and he lives in California. And he wrote a book called Small Bold Great Mountain. And this part is called The Search for Freedom. It says, probably like many people, I wrestled at length with the question of freedom in my teens and early 20s. I was a late flower child, having been born in 1956. I just caught the tail end of the good stuff. Through much of my early years, I worshipped the ideal of freedom and longed for the true experience of it. Rather than becoming a bomb-throwing anarchist, though, I became more of a flower-waving, philosophical anarchist. Nevertheless, I took this aspiration to freedom very seriously, and I had a profound intuition that freedom is possible, that there is this potential we have as human beings to be totally free, and that there is something utterly pure, uninhibited, and uninhibitable within us. My experience, however, was one of colliding with endless restrictions and frustrations. First it was getting away from my parents, then it was the law, then it was not having enough money. I thought that this or that was standing in my way, and if only it wasn't there, I would be free. I was completely bewildered. No matter how much I tried to be free and unhindered by conventions, forms, and structures, mostly by defying these things, there always seemed to be another layer and another layer and another layer. I kept meeting up with limitations, and as a result, I was constantly feeling frustrated. I was suffering, and I had no idea why. I left England and began my travels in hopes of finding freedom somewhere else. I went to Southeast Asia and pursued the Dionysian lifestyle of eat, drink, be merry, sex, drugs, rock and roll, dancing in the moonlight, on the beaches with one hand waving free. But inside me was a feeling that I was coming to a desperate crunch. I knew intuitively that this decadent path really was not leading to freedom. So I searched some more. I took off to the northeast of Thailand, where hardly any Western tourists ever went, and found myself wandering into a forest monastery. It was the branch of Ajahn Chah's monastery, where his Western monks lived. It's important to know that the Thai forest tradition is the stiff end of an already narrow orthodoxy. It's the strict observance of an already conservative tradition. What was immediately apparent to me, however, was that these people were living the most bizarrely austere life, yet they were also the most cheerful characters I'd ever met. They were getting up at 3 a.m, eating one meal a day, drinking a cup of tea twice a week, sleeping on thin grass mats, having no sex, definitely no sex, no drugs, alcohol, or rock and roll. Yet they were fully at ease, very friendly and uncomplicated people. I asked myself, what have they got to laugh about? How come they're so happy when their lifestyles are so restricted? Then I met Ajahn Chah, the teacher. If I thought the monks seemed pretty content with their lot, meeting him was even more striking. Ajahn Chah appeared to be the happiest man in the world. He had been living as a monk in the forest without any sex, music, or drink for 40 years. You would imagine someone would be pretty dried up by then. But here was a man who was totally at ease with life. In fact, he was thoroughly enjoying it, totally content. So, Ajahn Chah has this quote that says, if you let go a little, you will find a little happiness or contentment. If you let go a lot, you'll find a lot of happiness or contentment. And if you let go completely, you will find complete happiness and contentment. So, we as lay people, as householders, we just start where we are. But I think it's really inspiring to read about monks like Ajahn Chah and to read things by Ajahn Amaro or Ajahn Sumedho or other people who have practiced really deeply, and to know that that's a possibility for all human beings. And so I think that's just to have that not as a way to feel frustrated or discontent with our own lives, but just to see how by putting these training precepts into practice, to the best of our ability, that to see what effect that has in terms of how our lives unfold. So we have a few minutes now. If people have questions or would like to share any thoughts on either successes or struggles with gratitude or the training precepts, great to hear from people.
Something that came to mind during your talking tonight was on the morality piece is, in life, in the modern world, sexual relations are often a term that comes up with that is consensual sex, that, for some reason if it's consensual, it's okay. And what I thought about was people in life sometimes say okay to something, we really, it's not really okay, but it's kind of a compromise. Or, you know, I think sometimes we do that with food too. We eat when we're not hungry, and we say yes to things we don't really want to keep the peace and things like that. And I just wanted to bring that piece up, that really, you know, to look at these actions and stuff in terms of non-harming takes it to a whole other level, I think. And to really not harm ourselves or others, we have to be more careful what we say yes to, you know, when maybe when we should say no.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, if we have, you know, if we've reflected in that way, then we have more of a likelihood that when a situation comes up, that, you know, that we'll choose a wholesome action, and that's really what, you know, the practice of these precepts is about, is not, you know, I mean, we've all made mistakes and we're all going to make some more. But, and so then when that happens, we can use that practice of reflection. And then, but to just thought of the Buddha's instructions to his son. His son Rahula became a monk. At one point, and he was giving him some instructions, and he told him to reflect before he did an action, to reflect during the action, and to reflect after the action. And so kind of put that in the back of our minds too, because that's something that we can reflect on ourselves.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, Mona. I noticed that when Gail was mentioning the five precepts and abstaining from sexual misconduct and abstaining from intoxicants, how I felt, given that, you know, there's some people here tonight, I've been around for a while, and I'm thinking, you know, well, what are they thinking about that? No sex and drugs, no rock and roll. And I just noticed, given my own conditioning, you know, I still really, at least in my mind, really, you know, think, you know, I don't want to give those things up. And, but, you know, upon reflection, and I think that's a really good example with, you know, maybe we're referring to sex, about having sex when you kind of feel like it's just not the right thing to do. Some people describe, I think, maybe Thich Nhat Hanh, in terms of what is appropriate, or non-harming sex would be only within the context of a long-term relationship. But I just kind of noticing those two parts of me, one that says, oh, I don't want to give those things up. And then another part of me is just really seeing how I really suffer around things as I reflect things the way I think sometimes with intoxicants and drugs, and just doing things that are really harmful. And so, and I've noticed how it troubles my mind, reflecting on things. And when I'm sitting, it's like, oh, those things do hurt. So I just kind of appreciate you broaching that.
And thanks, yeah, too, because we didn't really, I'm sure Mark will be talking, I think he'll be continuing on with this topic, and he'll be going much more into depth and with each of the different precepts. But yeah, it says for Theravada monks, they do choose to be celibate, but that's not what the householders are. That's not the precept that householders practice. It is. I mean, the sexual misconduct is things like breaking our commitments in relationships, or other harmful things. But and the encouragement is definitely for it to be in a committed relationship. But the other thing is, we can practice, we can choose any of these precepts to practice. We don't have to practice all of them at the same time, or, you know, it's just a thing that we can start to investigate. So wherever we're at, you know, we can choose something and explore that.
I was just got back yesterday, last night, from Costa Rica, where I went with 8 other students from my high school, kind of as an end-of-year trip, along with our teacher. And one of the things I noticed that's related to what you're talking about is the joy of generosity. And really, more surprising, the most surprising is the joy part of it. Just seeing over and over that it actually feels really good when we're living together like that, of the responsibility of taking care of each other. And that it wasn't a burden at all, but actually a joy to be able to have something that you can give to others. And feeling, and it's related to that switching of the view in the mind from one of just self-centeredness and looking out for oneself, of one that includes more people, one that includes everyone, so that, and just that switch, just seeing over and over on that trip and in other parts of my life, that switch really makes all the difference, and that it just feels a lot better and more correct and more in tune with how it is to come out of that natural generosity.
Thank you. Someone shared one night that the, I forget if it was in Burma or Thailand, there's this real attitude that someone receiving your gift is like the, you have a very deep gratitude for when your gift is received, and I think that that's a lovely thing to reflect on also. Yes.
Just some simple gratitudes today. I was walking home from the dog park, which is always the happy thing with the dogs running. And then I was walking to Matthew's park, and I was noticing that I was walking better. I was in less pain than the day before, so I was grateful for that. And the border collie was leaving the park with its ball thing, so it was really happy. I was grateful for that. And I got to go to the park and run and play, and very grateful for the rain. The earth was just sucking it up. And then I saw these men biking to the park, and it was right after I was aware of less pain in my leg. And I noticed that one of the men had a arch leg. And I was just so grateful that Dr. Walker saw this and had an example of your leg. And that he was biking.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I'm really grateful for what you read and the sentiment about freedom, and that really shift in perspective of when the external force gets, when my kids get older, when I have more time to myself, that it's really about still thinking it through, but that freedom is an internal experience that I can touch into every time I meditate and every time I remember to breathe.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that a lot of gratitude can arise out of hearing these teachings. And to know that there's a lot of contentment that can arise just by our attitude and our awareness of the way things are. Anybody else? Stop there.